Let me welcome my first guest to the programme, the wonderful Tony Gosling. Welcome back to Radio Jones.
Hi, Pippa.
Thanks, Tony. Now then, of course, we've just seen the announcement of a ceasefire in eastern Ukraine, being announced after a number of hours of talks between Russia, Ukraine, France and Germany. Putin allegedly being the first spokesperson to come out and announce the ceasefire starting on Sunday. First of all, why Sunday? What can we read into that, Tony?
Well, I think it's the idea is that it gives the various factions a chance to establish their positions. I would imagine it might mean that one side or another side will, you know, do a bit more today. It's a pity. And also, of course, there is a sort of communication gap going on here because the EU powers and Kiev refused to negotiate directly with the Donbass rebels. So Putin is kind of piggy in the middle. And it's obviously going to take a bit of time for him to then go and agree things with, you know. So there's bound to be, I think, in this particular case, because the people who are actually doing the fighting are not at the table, are not allowed to be at the table. There's bound to be a bit of lag in things actually happening. So I mean, my hopes, I'm afraid, are not great. I mean, I was over in Moscow actually at the NATO summit last year, where the first ceasefire was announced by NATO, which did not hold very long at all. So my hopes are not great about this. And I think there's one key thing that, you know, you've got to have the people who are doing the fighting at the table. I mean, it just seems bizarre.
Yeah, that would seem, in my, you know, humble opinion, that would seem to make sense to me as well. Why not then? What, I mean, what grounds were they not allowed to join?
Well, it's just that basically the Kiev was saying, well, we're not going to talk to them directly, but we're happy to talk to Russia. Now, of course, this brings in Putin into the frame.
Yes.
He is kind of their representative, which, you know, quite clearly he supports to a certain extent what they're doing. Quite to what extent there's military support is dubious, but certainly there's been humanitarian support going in with these white trucks, the aid convoys going from Russia into Donbass. Now, but I think, you know, at the crux of all this, we have to think about, you know, what is this whole business about self-determination of a region? I mean, say, for example, if Bristol decided that they didn't like what Westminster was doing, could Bristol decide, well, actually, well, we're going to secede from the United Kingdom? I mean, a bit like, in a way, in Spain with Catalonia, them saying, oh, look, we don't want anything more to do with Madrid. We think that, actually, we're paying loads of taxes to Madrid, and we're not getting enough back in return, so we've had enough of it all. And this, you know, go back a bit further to Yugoslavia, for example, when Tito died, and the West was very happy, NATO was very happy to recognise the state of Kosovo right at the beginning of that conflict, which many people say, well, it was actually the recognition of the independence of Kosovo from Yugoslavia that led to all the conflict going on. So, you know, there's real massive double standards as to whether the rebels are the good rebels or the bad rebels. You know, the bad rebels in Ukraine, the good rebels in Syria. We just get this all the time, and we've had a whole succession of bad guys. You know, we've had Saddam, the bogeyman, Gaddafi, the bogeyman, Assad, the bogeyman, and now it's Putin, the bogeyman.
But that would justify their reluctance to allow those fighting the fight to be at the table, because, of course, as you said at the beginning, they want to bring Putin into the frame. Well, they've done that very, very well. Explain to me, then, we've got Russia, Ukraine, France and Germany.
Well, yeah, I mean, they're the EU representatives, aren't they? And it was really interesting, just before the Charlie Hebdo attacks back at the beginning of January in Paris, that literally 2 days before those attacks, François Hollande, the French president, was saying, right, you know, well, it's time to roll back these sanctions with Russia. We've had enough. And as soon as we get some kind of, you know, something positive going on in Ukraine, you know, we need to do it fast. You know, he was talking about fast-tracking the end of sanctions because it's really hitting the European economies. Now, you know, a lot of this is funny thing is, a lot of this is driven by the US. US behind the scenes saying, oh, you know, the whole, it's them, for example, that's bringing in, talking about, anyway, bringing in troops and armoured equipment, that sort of thing, into Europe. And yet this is a complete disaster for the European economies, for the EU countries. So, but they are the representatives.
But how do they get to be the representatives? Why France and Germany?
Well, because they're the two big powers who are economically, I think, affected by what happens.
So it is that simple?
Yeah.
So they put their hands up and they say, yes, we want to be there, or they...
Well, I've also... Well, because they're the two big powerhouses, economic powerhouses of Europe, and in, at least in Northern Europe, you know, so... I think that the countries like Greece, for example, aren't so affected by it. Spain isn't so far affected by it because they're not so close to Russia. They haven't got so many... that's what a lot of this is about the whole link between Europe and Russia being quite an important economic link, which is now being severed mostly through pressure from the United States.
Mm. Well, most of us, I think, listening know the history of America fighting proxy wars on, you know, other people's soil. They've got a good history with that. NATO's role in this, an indispensable role in Ukraine at the moment, and with its own aims in sight.
Yeah, well, I mean, quite clearly, there's a real problem with Ukraine joining NATO, and Ukraine is saying it wants to join NATO. NATO is saying it wants Ukraine to join. It does seem this is going to be fast-tracked in one way or another, which is worrying, isn't it, in lots of different ways. I mean, imagine, as Noam Chomsky was saying on Channel 4 News, imagine if Mexico was to join the Russian Federation. You know, that's what this is like. And, of course, in the United States' case, there would be, coups and God knows what before that was ever allowed to happen. In Mexico's case, Mexico being right on the, southern border of the United States. You know, this is starting to reignite those old Cold War tensions. I mean, I think the real reason that Russia has been focused on is because, this is all to the... And one of the things that gets very rarely talked about in the Western media coverage of it is the importance of the Crimea strategically, because the Crimea gives the Russians access to the Black Sea, and the Black Sea fleet gets access through the Bosphorus, through Istanbul, into the Mediterranean. So it enables the Russians to influence what happens in the Middle East through the Black Sea fleet. I mean, for example, the Israelis and the Americans apparently, not last summer, the summer before, were practicing firing rockets towards Damascus from their ships in the Mediterranean. And the Russians, many people believe, actually brought some of those missiles that were heading for Damascus down using their guided missile destroyers. So imagine if there is no Russian influence in the Eastern Mediterranean, the ships in the Eastern Mediterranean, all of a sudden you've got basically NATO ruling the waves in the Med, and that would bring a big difference to what can and cannot happen in the Middle East because of the projection of Russian sea power in the Med. So that's why the Russians have to hang on to Crimea. Not only that, there's the vast majority of the population in Crimea are pro-Russian and anti-Kiev for the same sort of reasons. I mean, I actually got a friend who's got a house in Crimea, and they're saying, well, look, you know, we're fed up with what's been happening over the last 10 years from Kiev because they are taking massive amounts of money. It's quite a wealthy part of the country, and we're seeing absolutely nothing. The government in Kiev is spending nothing on the infrastructure down here at all. So there was a real resentment about them paying fantastic amounts of taxes to Kiev and seeing nothing in return for it. So they were, and also, of course, the other factor in all of this is the fascist parties in power in Kiev in some of the key positions, like defence minister, security minister, and when the BBC did their programme a couple of nights ago about what happened a year ago, the coup in Kiev, the Maidan protests, the protesters being shot, 77 altogether, protesters and police, and then that creating a power vacuum, the parliament building being stormed, the government being replaced. You know, this whole business, to me, smacks of a fascist-style coup. That is to say, the people that came into power afterwards were those behind the shootings.
Yeah, well, right. But it's even perhaps even than that. You mentioned there that NATO want Ukraine to be part of NATO, and Ukraine want to be part of NATO. I got that the right way around, yeah. NATO want Ukraine, and Ukraine want to be in NATO. But the fact is... if we look at the present Ukraine government, which is we have to remember how it, you know, it's a year ago today, isn't it, that the Maidan Square was kicking off in Kiev. And the fact is that the representatives, if you like, of that government there are already in the pockets of those who want them to be in NATO.
Well, they are, to be fair, we've had a presidential election. We've also had parliamentary elections. in Ukraine since then. Obviously, all regions apart from the troubled regions in the east. But it is a key state, and I think this is one of the reasons. I mean, I look at often look at governments, that is to say the cabinet, the people around the table who are making the big decisions about how public money is spent, policy, defence policy, that kind of thing. And it's pretty clear that the fascists, those from those two fascist parties, the Pravi Sector and Sloboda, have got a ridiculously overblown share of the powerful portfolios, like the security, the defence portfolios. And that doesn't represent the people at all, despite all these elections. And so, I mean, for example, just today, here on the BBC, I was listening on Five Live just a little earlier on today, and there was an interview with a businessman in Donetsk who's joined the struggle against Kiev as one of the rebels. And he's just sort of down tools in his business and picked up a gun, and he's now a fighter over there. And he's saying, well, the problem is, every time we have a ceasefire, the military, the Kiev government military, break the ceasefire, and of course we've got to shoot back at that point, and otherwise they just overrun us. And then we had the BBC coming off the back of that and saying, well, of course, it's always the rebels that break the ceasefire. It's like the presenter isn't listening at all to that particular point of view. So it's an incredibly one-sided view of events that we're getting. But I think absolutely crucial is the right of self-determination of Donbass. We need to have some kind of, international observers in there. What do these people want? And I think we've got to be absolutely clear about this, because we've got a big problem in the world right now, in the United States particularly, and the EU, of enormous great debts being serviced by governments. Many of the regions around, I mean, like Catalonia, for example, like Donetsk in Ukraine, finding it just impossible to give credibility to a government that is so incompetent in managing their affairs. So there needs to be some kind of way of putting pressure on those governments by saying, well, look, if you can't run the country, then a country's going to split up and people, regions, are going to start running themselves. And I think that's what's happening here in Donbass.
But the likelihood of that happening, Tony?
Well, at some point, it's got to crack, hasn't it? I mean, you cannot run a country based on simply the government simply being a debt collection agency for the banks, where people, individuals and businesses are going to the wall, and people are running up massive amounts of debt in order to survive. I mean, here in Britain, we've got record private debt where many millions of people are using their credit cards to pay their rent, etc. The government has made a mess of things, and they're supposed to be acting in the interests of the people, but it's like the borrower is servant to the lender. The government is servant to the banks, and that's what's happening increasingly in America. And so I actually think that with also, I mean, even Venice has had a vote about seceding from Italy, for example, that comes a point where these debts start to bite so much that people say, well, we've had enough of this. We're not going to simply be paying off debts. That's not what the government's for. It's there to provide public services. And the public services, as they get denuded, people just get more and more annoyed by the fact that they're paying their taxes just straight to the banks. I mean, in Greece, for example, the Greek bailout money, which they've been talking about having, I mean, there's a possibility, of course, that Greece might secede from the EU, as another example. That money that goes as a bailout to the Greeks then goes simply, you hear a ching-ching sound, and then it goes straight over to the people who are holding the Greek debt, which is mostly the Germans. So although they're talking about bailing out the Greeks, the money isn't actually going to Greece. It's going ching-ching in Greece, and then it's going straight to Germany.
In the meantime, of course, we have the ceasefire coming into effect on Sunday, and you and many other commentators are not holding much hope for it. And Merkel and the rest of them are saying if it's broken, then there will be further sanctions against Russia. Again, a pretty self-destructive kind of next step.
Well, all that needs to happen, of course, on Saturday night, Sunday, is that the Kiev forces do what we were hearing on Five Live here in Britain earlier on they've been doing, which is breaking the ceasefires, for the West to say, oh, told you so, and there's going to be more sanctions on Russia. Because, I mean, the list I mentioned earlier on, Saddam, Gaddafi, Assad, now Putin. Where is all this leading? Because Putin is not the sort of guy that can be pushed around like Colonel Gaddafi, you know, the guy in his Bedouin tent could. And also, the Russians are very much ready. They've been ready really since the end of World War II for a conflict with the West. I think our leaders are dragging us into a potential nuclear war here. That's how serious this is. And those same leaders are the ones who many of them are implicated in particularly here in Britain, in the child abuse scandal, which has been covered up in a most horrific fashion. I mean, we've got an election taking place in a couple of months here in Britain. And the revelations last year, middle of last year, were that many people in the Conservative Party and civil servants were connected with very serious child abuse. We've also heard that the Dolphin Square Place, possibly even murder of young children.
Yeah.
And yet what we're seeing is a succession of the things like the Rolf Harris case, which is very low-hanging fruit. The idea is to give the public an idea that something's being done about it. But actually nothing's been done about the really serious crimes at the very top. And I say the very top because this goes right to the royal family. If you look at what's happened in the Jersey, Haute de la Garenne scandal, what's happened there is that the local people who have done a lot of investigating for themselves, along with the police, until the police chief was removed from his job, have made it absolutely clear there are two or three people in the government of Jersey and other places in the Channel Islands that have to be removed because they have been covering up this for years. And these requests have been sent again and again to the royal family who make these appointments. I mean, there's nothing democratic about Jersey, really, very little. These key appointments are made by the Crown, and the Crown has refused to do absolutely anything about it. Now, I think, if the royal family wants to have any credibility, it's got to act. It's got to act now. The problem, of course, being is that there are all sorts of other clouds hanging around the royal family, like the death of Diana, for example. So we have a real serious constitutional crisis on its way unless something's done about this. And I think that's one of the reasons that they're now thinking, well, you know, what the hell? I mean, that's I think, the attitude amongst the really powerful ruling elite in Britain, which is, we don't really care that much if there's some kind of war with Putin because we don't like the Russian independence. And that's actually where we are. So there's serious trouble brewing if something's not done about this child abuse scandal, because the election is clearly being used as an excuse to kick this into the long grass. And those abusers, possibly even those murderers too, are still walking the streets and still in position.
Interesting that you bring it to that point as well. I mean, as I mentioned to you earlier, Sky News is running a big story about this hacker group, Anonymous, who, as you pointed out to me, it's actually called Operation Death Eaters, is the title of their latest, intention, if you like. They've decided to raise this issue. What do you make of that? That, first of all, we've got Anonymous who plan to expose the abusers in whichever way they can. And secondly, that the mainstream media is putting so much focus on that at this point.
Well, look, the problem is, who is Anonymous? I mean, you know, they want to stay anonymous. And, of course, the trouble with any of these kind of anonymous groups that are doing these campaigns is that they are very much liable to be infiltrated. I mean, if, say, for example, you've got an anonymous Twitter account, and the person who's running it is legitimate but wants to stay anonymous, what happens if the state, GCHQ, or one of these other intelligence services then hacks that Twitter account and starts using it as their own? What can the person do? You've got a real problem if you've got any kind of campaigning or journalistic organisation where the people running it want to stay out of the limelight and, as the name of the group says, anonymous. You really, I think, need to have people who are either in another part of the world and very open about who they are, or in this part of the world and open about who they are. Because I don't really trust these kind of screen names. You know, you get all sorts of, like, Colonel Jenny Sparks with a kind of picture of a cartoon character from some military cartoon strip is supposed to be a campaigner. Now, look, come on a minute. We're going down a very strange road here, where these could very, very easily be taken over and manipulated if they weren't even created by the intelligence services.
Wonderful. Tony, as always, to listen to you is very, very inspiring, to say the least. Thank you so much for joining us once again on Radio Jones.